people were on edge. You couldn't have set the stage better for something to sort of push them over the edge. I kind of liken it to a heavyweight fighter with a glass jaw. America at that time, we were a heavyweight fighter, but we had a glass jaw. In other words, if you just hit in just the right spot, you know, with enough force, you could take down this heavyweight person. And that's what, you know, Wells wound up doing with this broadcast.
Ladies and gentlemen,
ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News.
In a way, Americans were very naive because they had almost just 100% trust in what they heard on the radio. If a news reporter said something on the radio, they believed it. You know, they really had a trust in this new form of media. This had no concept of someone using this in any other way other than just to tell them what was really happening.
Further details of the catastrophe at Grover's Mill are coming in. The strange creatures, after unleashing their deadly assault, crawled back in their pit and made no attempt to prevent the efforts of the firemen to recover the bodies and extinguish the fire. The combined fire departments of Mercer County are fighting the flames which menace the entire countryside.
It really doesn't matter how many people heard the broadcast. That's not the point. The point was that the people who heard the broadcast, many of them, then ran out and told other people what was happening, what they thought was happening. And so it sort of spread like wildfire.
That grinning, glowing, globular invader of your living room is an inhabitant of the pumpkin patch, and if your doorbell rings and nobody's there, that was no Martian. It's Halloween.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 8. And I am very excited to be unleashing this installment of the program on you folks because we are celebrating the 75th anniversary of the legendary War of the Worlds radio broadcast, which aired on October 30th, 1938. Thankfully, I managed to get all of the timing done right for this episode, and you are actually listening to this program on the 75th anniversary of the War of the Worlds broadcast. To celebrate the occasion, we are welcoming David Accord, who is the author of the new book, When Mars Attacked, which details the infamous Orson Welles program, which set off a panic throughout America. Over the course of this conversation, we are going to discuss Orson Welles' remarkable childhood, his early life, and his rise to fame, as well as the explosion of radio in the 1930s, and how those two threads crossed with the War of the Worlds broadcast. We'll also find out about all the various elements which came together to make the War of the Worlds panic happen, and we'll separate the facts from the fiction as to what actually went down on October 30th, 1938, and what the intent behind it all was. We'll also delve into the conspiracy theories surrounding the broadcast, as well as connections between War of the Worlds and the UFO phenomenon. Altogether, this is an episode which likely will provide BOA audio listeners with a wealth of new information on the infamous War of the Worlds broadcast, which has entrenched itself in urban legend, paranormal lore, and pop culture history for the last 75 years, as David Accord tells us about When Mars Attacked. For those of you who are unfamiliar with David Accord, please allow me to take a moment and provide you with a little background on him. David Accord is the author of When Mars Attacked, Orson Welles, The War of the Worlds, and the radio broadcast that changed America forever. He is an accomplished author and veteran Washington, D.C. journalist, having spent more than a decade covering complex federal regulations in the nation's capital for various business publications. He has also served as managing editor and editor-in-chief, respectively, for two international business publishing firms. He is currently the director of communications and executive editor for a national trade association in the D.C. area. David is also the author of What Would Lincoln Do? Lincoln's Most Inspired Solutions to Challenging Problems and Difficult Situations, as well as Success Secrets of Sherlock Holmes, Life Lessons from the Master Detective. He lives in Arlington, Virginia, and received his BFA from Arkansas Tech University in 1993 and his MFA in English from Penn State University in 1996. You can find out more about David's book at www.whenmarsattacked.com. Pretty simple, all one word, whenmarsattacked.com. Check it out. And with all that said, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on September 16th, 2013. David Accord, talking about When Mars Attacked, Orson Welles, The War of the Worlds, and the radio broadcast that changed America forever, on BOA Audio, Season 8. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio, Season 8. And we are celebrating a historic anniversary here on the program this week. Hopefully, if my haphazard scheduling works out properly, you are listening to this on October 30th, which happens to be the 75th anniversary of the infamous 1938 War of the Worlds broadcast from Orson Welles. And to celebrate the occasion, we've got author David Accord here on the program. He is the author of the new book, When Mars Attacked, which is all about that 1938 War of the Worlds broadcast. And it's earned a place in paranormal lore over the years. It's really earned a place in pop culture lore and really society in general. War of the Worlds, it's supplanted the original book in a lot of ways. It's become this sort of catchphrase for mass hysteria. And as I said, it's celebrating its 75th anniversary here this year in 2013, and thankfully David has put out a new book covering that monumental radio broadcast. So he reached out to me this summer. He's a longtime BOA Audio listener and definitely somebody I wanted to have on the program here in Season 8 to discuss War of the Worlds and what it all means, not just for the world of the paranormal, but for society in general. So welcome to the program, David. It's going to be a fun and fascinating conversation, I'm sure.
Tim, it's a great honor to be here. As you mentioned, I've been listening to you ever since season one, so I'm just really happy to be here.
Awesome, awesome. Now you're part of the lexicon of BOA Audio, so welcome
That's
to
great, yeah.
The club. And I should mention, you can find the book via whenmarsattacked.com. That's the website. Once again, the book is When Mars Attacked. And I honestly, folks, absolutely loved this book. I cannot put it over enough. It was tremendous. I'm a huge Orson Welles fan, but really only Citizen Kane. That's still like my favorite movie of all time, and I've seen it probably a dozen times at least. I just absolutely love that film, and really learned a whole lot more about not just Orson Welles, but sort of what led him into Citizen Kane, which of course was this big War of the Worlds broadcast. So I really loved the book and learned a tremendous amount about it, and it was fantastically well written. I really can't put you over enough for that, David. You never know what you're going to get sometimes with these books, but I love
it. That's the greatest compliment I could receive. Thank you.
Oh, no problem, and I mean it. I'm not blowing smoke up your butt here, man. I mean it. It was awesome. So, you know, traditionally as we go here, starting out, give us a little bit of your bio, your background. Who is David Accord? And how did you get interested in the esoteric, and, you know, how did all this lead to When Mars Attacked?
Sure. Well, I am I'm a writer and an editor. I live here in the Washington, D.C. area. I've been here for about 15 years, and I've actually been interested in sort of my two really great interests have been sort of the paranormal, you know, and cryptozoology and UFOs on one hand and old-time radio on the other. Mm. I've been interested in both of those since I was just a kid. I can remember, you may remember these two, the old Daniel Cohen paperback books from the 70s and the 80s about, you know, Bigfoot and mysterious creatures and things like that. I gobbled those up. In fact, I still have them somewhere. So I was really interested in that. And then when I was about 10 years old, actually, my parents bought me on cassette, this is way before CDs, a copy of the War of the Worlds broadcast, and I didn't know that much about it, but they said they thought I would really enjoy it, and I literally wore that tape out. I must have listened to it over the years, you know, 50 times. I mean, I pretty much had it memorized. It just blew me away.
Yeah.
And even though I knew it was fake, every time I listened to it, you know, I was still just amazed. And of course, I wanted to find out, you know, more about it and why people, you know, thought it was real. And it really sparked my interest in Orson Welles and science fiction and old time radio in general, and has really just kept up with it over the years. And about 3 years ago, I knew that the 75th anniversary was coming up, and I decided to look around for some books. And there's been some other books written on the subject, but I felt with my background in reporting here in D.C. and editing that I could maybe take a stab at doing my own book on it, because I felt like there were some aspects of it that hadn't really been illuminated before. And also, since I was living in D.C., which is home to the National Archives, I decided to make use of that. I went to the National Archives and just found a treasure trove of material that had just been sitting there for years, and that really I couldn't find it. Other books and other things that had been written about the broadcast, they hadn't really got into these very much. I mean, the National Archives has the actual copies of every letter of complaint that they received.
Oh, wow.
About the broadcast back in 1938, and not photocopies, the originals. You can just handle the originals, you know. Hundreds of these letters, and I found an internal report from the FCC about the broadcast and all the stuff that was going on. I put all of that in the book, and so that's when I knew I was really on to something, and that was about 2.5 years ago, and it took me about two and a half years to write the book.
Okay.
And so I've sort of come full circle after starting out, you know, 30-odd years ago when I was 10 years old listening to it. Now I've written a book about it.
Yeah, now you've written the book on it, yeah.
Right.
Well, like I said, I mean, it's interesting, and I would be, you know, obviously by the time the interview concludes, it'll be a non-workable poll in a sense, but it would be interesting to sort of take a poll on the people, you know, listening right now, and if they're anything like me, you know, you've kind of heard the story of War of the Worlds and the broadcast and everything, but there was so much detail involved in that that I had never even heard of before, which was really interesting. And again, kudos to you for that, because it really, in a way, it's kind of like this conversation, I hope, will sort of separate the fact and the fiction from War of the Worlds, because...
Well, yeah, that's great. I'm glad you picked up on that, because that's actually one of the reasons I wanted to write the book is, you know, so many, you know, over the years, you're right, there's been a lot of sort of like folklore that's been built up around the broadcast. And one of the, you know, things that drove me crazy and still drives me crazy is that they continue to refer to it as sort of a hoax. You know, they'll call it the War of the Worlds hoax or the hoax broadcast, when, you know, implying that it was intentional,
right?
Implying it was a practical joke or a prank, which is something else that you'll hear a lot, which, in fact, as I say in the book, you know, that's one of the sort of myths that I wanted to debunk, is that, you know, and this may, you know, surprise a lot of people, it's like, it wasn't intentional, you know? I know that, you know, Orson Welles himself sort of tried to muddy the record on this in later years, but it was an accident. It was a mistake. They really didn't mean to do it. And I think that's one of the more surprising things that people, you know, bring up to me about the book when they read it. It's like, well, I always thought that he did it on purpose.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And he set out to, like, scare people, you know, intentionally. And it's like, no, he was just trying to produce a really good radio play. And, you know, through a series of events, which we'll go through, it sort of got out of control.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. That's definitely, I hadn't really wrapped my mind around it, but that you kind of hit the nail on the head, especially like what I was saying earlier. I had always kind of thought that it was all a work, as they say in the wrestling business, you know, that
right.
It was all planned out. But apparently, that wasn't the case. But we'll get into that. Let's sort of ease into the story here. We'll start with the background on Orson Welles, because, as I said, I'm a big fan of Citizen Kane. I had heard that, you know, elements of Citizen Kane were informed by his background, but I couldn't really believe just how eerily similar it was to the life of Charles Foster Kane, his early life, and just how sad his life was in a lot of ways. It was really, it was like a combination of sad and bizarre, that he was like this bizarre sort of child genius. And then, you know, I'm throwing a lot at you here, so bear with me, but, you know, he's got the sad early life, he's a child genius, and then, you throw in, on top of that, this, all this sort of apocryphal stuff that we don't, we can't really even know for sure what's fact, what's fiction about his early childhood, which makes him even more sort of like of this like mythical character in a lot of ways.
Right. I call him a trickster in the book because in many ways, you know, Orson Welles, he is the ultimate trickster because he was fascinated with magic and sleight of hand. And he really enjoyed, you know, pulling tricks on people. And I think that's one of the reasons why people assume that the War of the Worlds broadcast was an intentional trick, is because sort of Orson Welles' personality and his persona was this sort of like wily old man, you know, and sort of always with a kind of a smirk on his face. But yeah, it's just a fascinating. He had a really fascinating background. He's born in Wisconsin. In 1915, very upper middle class or just outright wealthy family, but, you know, very mismatched parents. His father was sort of this eternal bachelor and out, you know, drinking and gambling all the time, and people were shocked when he decided to get married, and he married someone who was his polar opposite, and she was very cultured and refined, and they had one son, Richard, who did not turn out well. It's very, his story is very murky, exactly why there were so many problems with him. I think there were, he was institutionalized for much of his life, and they pretty much just cut him out of their life early on. And so when Orson was born a few years later, they sort of pinned all of their hopes on him, you know, and they sort of, I think, you know, I'm doing a little psychoanalyzing here, but I think they saw this as their chance to get things right, quote unquote, you know, and sort of get in there and do things right this time with Orson. But what they wound up doing was just spoiling him rotten, basically. And, you know, and so he was a spoiled child, but he was also just incredibly smart. Now, as you said, it's really hard to separate fact from fiction because Welles was, you know, he enjoyed sort of tricking people, and he told all these stories about his life, and he told them up until the day he died, and a lot of them just aren't true. And so it's hard, and he loved fooling his biographers, you know, and telling them the stories and getting them to print things that weren't true. So it's hard to know, but some of these stories about him, you know, speaking in complete sentences and, you know, when he was maybe 1.5, 2 years old and things like that. We don't know if those are true, but it is the case that he was very, very smart, and he was very aware of what was going on. He was very adult-like from an early age and, you know, could converse with adults and was very talented in, obviously in terms of acting and writing. And, you know, his mother, being a very cultured person, introduced him to the classics of literature at a very young age. And it all sounds great, but as you said, it was also very tragic, and here's where we get the parallels. You're absolutely right. When you read about his life, you see, okay, well, now we know where some of those things came from in Citizen Kane. His mother died when he was 9 years old. It had a, you know, a deep, deep impact on him. His father was an alcoholic who lingered for a few years after that, but died when Orson was 15. He was sent off to private school at a young age, grew up really in a private school, away from his father. And, it was just, if you had to create, you know, sort of like a fictional character, an interesting fictional character, you know, you couldn't do better than Orson Welles' real life. I mean, it's just fascinating.
Yeah. It's, like I said, it encompasses a whole range of emotions. Now, You mentioned here the brother Richard, which of course I'd never heard of before. What did we know what like became of him? Because obviously Orson Welles went on to become this, you know, world famous celebrity and sort of a you know, kind of a really obviously a world famous strange kind of celebrity.
Right.
As years went on, but was there contact between them? Do we know anything about that relationship?
Yeah, it's really interesting because we don't. And you know, and in the course of this book, writing this book, I pored over all the biographies, and there's really not a lot of information about. Now, he had some contact with Richard when he was a young boy, because Richard was actually, before he was institutionalized, probably in his teens, he was sent to the same private school that Orson eventually went to.
Mm-hmm.
But he caused so much of trouble there that he was kicked out, and then he was kind of homeless for a while, and he just sort of wandered around, and finally, there's speculation that he was basically schizophrenic. And of course, in that time, it wasn't really understood. And he was just institutionalized, and he sort of pops up here and there throughout Orson's life. I found a couple of references. Again, I wasn't really 100% satisfied with them, so I didn't put them in the book, but I found a couple of references in other books about Wells that Richard, you know, contacted him just sort of out of the blue, maybe, oh, gosh, when Orson was in his 30s or 40s, you know, he hadn't heard from him in years, and there had been some rumors that he was dead. And he just sort of contacted him, and we don't know if anything came of that. We do know that Orson was very, you know, he loved to talk about himself and his family, but he did not talk about his brother that much. So it remains this kind of interesting mystery. You know, biographers and researchers have been able to find out so much about Orson Welles, but that's the one area that still remains kind of murky. And I don't really know. You have to assume at this point Richard has passed away.
Yeah.
But I don't know when or where. I couldn't really find any, you know, concrete details there, or at least any details I felt comfortable enough to put in the book.
Hmm. Okay. And the other sort of like biographical mystery that was really weird that you mentioned in the book, that you concede in the book, that never received a full proper explanation as far as we know, was that we're sort of skipping ahead a little bit in the life of Wells, but he got married, and him and his wife had a daughter whom they named Christopher, and no one really quite knows why that went down.
And this drove me crazy. I'm so glad you brought this point, because it's a long book, and there's a lot of these details, and I just did, you know, research from one end to the other. But this is the one thing I could not find out. I said, well, certainly someone has, you know, said something about why they would name a daughter Christopher, you know, and not Christina or something else, you know. And I just, it was a relatively minor point, you know, and it had nothing to do with the War of the Worlds, but it just drove me crazy, you know, because I wanted to find out the answer. And there's just really, I could not find any, it's probably as soon as this airs, someone will email and say, oh, hey, this is why. But in all of the material that I collected and all the research I did, even the biographers were like, yeah, kind of interesting, he named her Christopher.
Yeah.
He didn't really go into why. So it does, yeah, it's just one of those quirky things. And there was probably some clever reason for it at the time, but I just haven't been able to uncover it.
Yeah, yeah. See, that would be somebody that would be interesting to try and track down.
She's actually written a memoir about life with her father, which I have not read. It came out, I want to say about a year and a half ago.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, and yeah, she would definitely have some great stories to tell, I'm sure.
I presume she does not explain the origins of her name, though.
Now I was able to find. See, that might be the the reason to buy the book.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah.
And find out why. Yeah.
Okay, so I'll sort of try and fill in a lot of details. We want folks to pick up this book, of course. So we're trying not to. You know, we're
going to spill all the beans. Yeah,
yeah, we're not going to spill all the beans, but you know, so I'll sort of do a rough sketch of the narrative as we go along here, just so folks can keep track of what's going on. So Wells bounces around. You know, he becomes immersed in sort of the acting scene at this private school, and then he ends up over in Ireland, where he lies and says he's a big Broadway star, and ends up in plays in Ireland for about a year or so. Then comes back and struggles to make it in theater and can't get a break in Broadway, bounces around the country for a while, then finally gets into Broadway, and this kind of coincides with the rise of radio. which you do a fantastic job. I guess I shouldn't be surprised, because you said, you know, you're an old-time radio fan, and it's, you know, it's probably sacrilege here that I'm in sort of the modern era of radio, and I don't really know too much about the origins of radio. So it was a great learning experience for me to sort of learn about the rise of radio, and it was interesting, too, in sort of comparison with, because I've seen sort of the rise of the internet, and I'd heard about how, you know, TV sort of gave rise, and you know, radio was all verklempt about what to do about TV. It's like always one new medium is always at war with the previous one. I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, the parallels you're spot on. I mean, when the internet came around, we had the same arguments being made as when TV started to eclipse radio. Yeah, it's really interesting how, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Right, right. And it's interesting, like, you talk about how you don't really think about it. And in a lot of ways, again, you know, I guess with the exception of the vast proliferation of pornography you see on the internet, you can kind of see the same rudimentary early stages in radio, where at first they were like, oh, this will be a good educational tool for people. They can learn things that, you know, they're airing lectures from college professors on the radio when it first started out. And it was like, well, there's not going to be any ads. We don't need ads on this thing. And it's like, just like the early internet. And now it's like, you know, who cares about educating people? You know, I want to put cartoons on there and stuff like that. So it's
and make money.
Exactly. And then slam it with ads all over the place.
Yeah.
So radio was very similar, the early days.
It really was. I mean, it started out, and they had these very lofty, idealistic expectations. You know, this would be a way. And in a way, they were right. It was a great equalizer. I mean, radios, after they, you know, they started out, they were sort of like for tinkerers and inventors, you know, and you had to be able to build your own radio, basically, in the early days. And so it was sort of a limited market. But when these mass radios started being mass-produced, and they were relatively cheap, and so pretty much anyone could get one, even if you were relatively poor. So they saw it as a great equalizer, as a way that both, you know, they could reach the poor and people who didn't have, you know, access to go see an opera, you know, or go see a symphony, or listen to, as you said, a college professor. They could, well, we can bring that to them. And that was very quaint and very nice, and it lasted about 30 seconds before these guys realized that, wow, we can make a lot of money. We can make a lot of money. And so they can make a lot of money broadcasting, and they can make a lot of money, you know, building radios and selling them. So the commercialization of radio happened, and it's really interesting. I talk about it a little in the book. It really, Orson Welles, you know, his sort of rise sort of parallels the rise of radio. They sort of came up at the same time. And he sort of rose through the ranks of Broadway and then crossed over to radio at just about the perfect time, just when it was really kind of hitting critical mass. And he was, you know, in the right place at the right time. He had already built up a reputation. As you said, he had some trouble on Broadway in the beginning, but he sort of he persevered. And before long, he was known as this sort of wonder kind, this sort of boy genius. He was the savior of the American theater, and he was able to transition into radio. And originally he did it because he needed the money.
Hmm.
But he quickly found that radio was considered kind of a lowbrow thing, and a lot of early radio actors were actually Broadway actors, and they wanted a legitimate careers on the stage. And they would do radio, but they wouldn't really admit that they did it, you know?
Yeah.
Because they just thought it was kind of beneath them, and they just did it for the money so that they could, you know, support themselves while they went after quote-unquote, you know, serious work. Well, what's interesting about Welles is that he quickly saw and said, hey, I can really do something with this. And I think it goes back to sort of, this was a marriage of both sort of the lowbrow and the highbrow. For him, because he grew up with a very highbrow mother and a very lowbrow father. And so he was exposed to both. He was exposed to kind of like the middle culture, the pop culture of the day, and the very highbrow. And he saw a way to meld those two. He saw a way that I can take my talents as a quote unquote serious actor, I can bring them to radio, and I can do things, that really haven't been done before. And boy, was he right, as we'll see. But yeah, that's, I think he was just really in the right place at the right time.
In addition to that, we can't, it would be remiss not to mention just the intense work ethic. Because as I said, I'm beating a dead horse here, but the things I learned from this book, you know, like most people I think probably think he went from theater to radio to movies, but really, as you point out in the book, you know, he's doing radio like all day. And then he would go and do theater at night, just an exhaustive workload.
He was just full of energy. I mean, he was like a human caffeine pill, kind of, you know. People just, and so many, you're exactly right to key in on that, because so many people who grew up around him and worked with him noticed it. It's like, when does this guy sleep? You know, he would just go and go and go, and he would do... Gosh, I don't know how many radio shows in a day, 4, 5, 6 radio shows, and there's a great anecdote that, you know, he would have to get across town from one studio to another, and he would actually hire an ambulance. This was in New York City in the mid-1930s, and he had to get across town very quickly to another studio, and of course there was no tape at that time, everything was live, and so he had to be there, and he would actually hire an ambulance and to take him across town. And of course, people would get out of the way because they would hear the siren and they would think, you know, they were taking someone who was mortally ill to the hospital, but it was just him, you know, just had to, he had to get to his radio day. And so after a full day of radio acting, then he would, and he took all the money he earned and just fed it back into his theatrical work. You know, he started theatrical troupes, and he funded his own plays and rented the venues and did all this stuff, and so it cost a lot of money. But yeah, he was probably working 18, 19, 20 hour days and just sort of, you know, subsisting on coffee.
Oh God. Do we know, is there any sort of like attribution for why he pushed himself so hard back then? Or was it just to fund the theater aspect of his life, so he sort of did both? Or, I mean, because at some point you would think that someone, you know, doing that well would rest on their laurels or just be happy in the radio end of things or something.
Right, and he was making a lot of money. I think he saw himself, I think he kind of, in a way, and again, this is just my personal opinion, others can have their own, and there's a lot of people out there who know a lot more about Orson Welles than I do, but I think in one respect, he bought into his own publicity. I mean, once people started calling him, you know, the savior of the American theater, he kind of started to believe it, and he definitely was an arrogant person. He had a very outsized ego. He thought he was special because, you gotta remember, he had been told from the time he could comprehend language that he was incredibly special. He was unique. He was just this fantastic person. And because he had this rather unusual intellect at such an early age, he was treated like a genius. Almost from the time he could, you know, could remember, people, adults, you know, sort of treated him special. So I think it was sort of baked into the cake a little bit in terms of his psyche. I mean, he thought of himself as someone who was going to change the world. And I also think, you know, speaking of the energy, I think it was just, it was a physiological thing. I think he was probably a little bit of a manic person.
Yeah.
And, you know, because we can see that, you know, and again, his brother with the psychological problems, and his parents who didn't have the greatest mental health as well. So I think you see a little bit of that. I think it was just a lot of manic energy and this sort of, you know, belief that he was going to change the world.
Yeah. 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 I can imagine, you know, if he was such a believer in his own remarkable powers, maybe it's sort of like he feels like he can't let them go to waste almost.
Exactly. And I think he also saw pretty early on that he wanted to get to Hollywood eventually. And I think he saw both, you know, he was sort of burning the candle at both ends. He saw both radio and the stage as a way to kind of raise his profile and get him out to Hollywood.
It's remarkable to think about, you know, we're jumping way ahead into his history and his life, but it's kind of remarkable to think about how it all fell apart down the line for him.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of what makes him so fascinating and why so many people just are kind of obsessed with him is this unrealized potential. You know, this sort of, you play this what-if game. You know, what if he had just, you know, certain things hadn't happened, and of course he was, he had a lot to blame. He takes a lot of the blame for himself because, you know, he was not the easiest person to work with, but he was, you know, undeniably a genius, and for whatever reason, you know, he had financial problems and he had deals that fell through, and he never got to make the movies that he wanted to make. And you could think of, you know, imagine if he had had the backing that, say, a Steven Spielberg or a George Lucas has today, he could have made, you know, a half dozen more movies at the same level as Citizen Kane. I mean, it would have been amazing.
Exactly, yeah. It's like he came along too early. You know, he could have been like Hitchcock or something.
Exactly.
Okay, so we sort of established, you know, he's made a name for himself. He, from what I understand, based on the book, I guess you could say he's one of the preeminent actors in the world of radio at this point, right?
Yes, and he was working very steadily, and he was also, you know, very well known on the stage as well, on Broadway.
Right, right. Most people obviously recognize his work with The Shadow. That seems to be the big precursor
right.
to all of this, right?
Exactly, and that's where he really kind of made his mark, and that The Shadow was really just sort of straight melodrama, very, you know, Pulp Fiction-esque, and he really kind of chewed up the scenery. If you listen to those old episodes, I mean, he really lays it on thick, and what's interesting is that he was so busy at the time that he would actually, he had a deal where he didn't have to show up until the day of the broadcast. And he didn't have to show up for rehearsals or anything else. He was so good that he could literally show up just as the show was going on the air. And a lot of times he hadn't even read the script. He would just read the lines cold and just get through the end of it. And he was paid an enormous amount of money for the time. I want to say about, you know, a couple $1,000 an episode. I can't remember exactly. But he was paid a lot of money for this, basically just a few minutes work each week.
I wish I was making that kind of money.
Exactly. Me too.
For that kind of work. And it's as someone who sometimes has to read things on the air, it's remarkable to hear somebody just get handed a script and go live like that. But I guess that's the skill involved.
And he also just, he had a great voice. He had sort of a great kind of baritone voice, and that he can really emote, you know. You listen to these episodes and you're like, okay, that is pretty good. You can imagine, you know, sitting in your darkened room, you know, back in the 30s, and there's no television and there's really nothing else to do, and you're a kid and you're listening to The Shadow. And the reason why he was, you know, paid so much money is because he really did a great job. And, you know, radio acting is hard. Not a lot of people could do it as well as he did.
The cool part about this, in a lot of ways, is folks can go and listen to The War of the Worlds. I mean, the whole thing's on YouTube. I was actually listening to a little bit of it today in preparation for the interview, and it still holds up, which is amazing. It's still really, really good and compelling stuff.
You're right. It's one of those few, regardless of how many times I've heard it, I just get pulled in every time. And yeah, it's all over the place on the internet. Everyone can go and listen to it. And yeah, it's just a fantastic piece of work.
Now, is that public domain yet, or is that still
in the possession of someone? It's such a murky issue with those. You know, you can find all these old time radio shows on the internet, you know, and they're just sort of floating around there for free, and the copyright status of a lot of them hasn't really, you know, it's kind of murky. But now, you know, I know the script for The War of the Worlds is copyrighted. The script for that broadcast, it was copyrighted by Howard Koch, who wrote it. He worked for Orson Welles, and I actually, you know, I reprint portions of it in my book, but I had to get permission from the estate of Howard Koch, you know, to be able to do that. So I know that the script is copyrighted, but, you know, and this is something that Welles complained about back in the 70s, because a lot of people started, you know, making old vinyl records, recordings of the broadcast back in the 60s and 70s and selling them, and he never saw any money off of it. And so it's out there. I don't know the copyright status definitively. I mean, it's a case with a lot of those shows. You know, you can find The Shadow and
right.
Suspense and, you know, Lum and Abner and all those shows out there. So
let's set the stage a little bit here for the 1938 broadcast, because there was a lot going on in the world that sort of, I guess you could say, led to this reaction that befell the broadcast. You know, there was the Depression, of course. Then there was the percolating war in Europe, And then there was what I learned here from the book was this sort of like meteor flap that happened in the summer before War of the Worlds, which I'd never heard of before until
right.
reading the book.
Yeah, it's something I came across when I was doing research for it. And, you know, I have to preface it by saying I don't think this was, you know, this was by no means this incredibly important event that, you know, really got people primed for it. But I think along with everything else, it certainly contributed. As you said, I think you look at America in the late fall of 1938 when this broadcast occurred, and it's really a country on edge. People are very concerned. First of all, the Great Depression isn't over yet. It's still going strong. Things had started to pick up a little bit in terms of the economy, but then they cratered again in 1937, and so people are just weary. It's been almost, you know, 7 or 8 years of just, you know, really horrible economic news. And then you've got Hitler rattling his saber over in Europe and threatening to invade Czechoslovakia, and that people were extremely concerned about that. They did not want another world war, but yeah, it was looking more and more inevitable. And Hitler was just this sort of, you know, bogeyman, you know, kind of for the world, and he was just this incredibly, incredibly scary figure. So yeah, people were on edge, and you couldn't have set the stage better for something to sort of push them over the edge. I kind of liken it to a heavyweight fighter with a glass jaw, you know, sort of like America at that time. We were a heavyweight fighter, but we had a glass jaw. In other words, if you just hit in just the right spot, you know, with enough force, you could take down this heavyweight person. And that's what, you know, Wells wound up doing with this broadcast. But one of the other things I found, as you said, was this, you know, leading up to the broadcast across through the summer and fall, and it was across the country, different places, mainly around the mid-Atlantic and then the Northeast. There were a series of these meteors and fireballs that were seen across the sky, and they made news. They didn't really make national news, but they made regional news, and so it was still to people in a good portion of the country, you know, there were these sort of strange meteor sightings, and the biggest one occurred in the summer on June 24th in this little town about 35 miles north of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania, and it was literally a 450 metric ton meteor, and it came down and it exploded in the sky over this tiny little town. I believe it's pronounced Chicora, Pennsylvania, and it's just like, what is going on? I mean, you've got the Depression, you've got bad economy, you've got threat of world war, and now you have these giant meteors exploding over, you know, across the sky, and it was really something. And now the Pittsburgh meteor actually did make, I would say, national news. It was in a lot of different newspapers, but you had others. You had big meteor sightings up in Rochester, New York. They said it resembled a skyrocket. Someone else, you know, at a planetarium said it was about half the size of the moon. So, I mean, it was really a big deal for people because they weren't used to this. So I think these sightings, and again, what you were doing was you had already sort of a rattled public. They were already somewhat unsettled. And now you've got them literally looking up at the sky and seeing strange things falling from the sky. And so I think in a very subtle, maybe kind of subconscious way, that helps set the stage for the broadcast too.
Right, because it's important to note that there wasn't the UFO phenomenon as we know it back then. People weren't thinking of flying saucers. So the idea of things falling from the sky, it had to be imprinted into their minds in a way, and it did with the meteor flap. So that would kind of lead them to say, you know, for this to become believable in a sense, because they've seen and heard of these types of events already happening in the first place. You know what I mean?
It's a great point. The term flying saucer wouldn't enter the national lexicon until 1947, as you know, with the Kenneth Arnold sighting.
Right.
And, you're right. I mean, nowadays it's sort of ubiquitous in pop culture, you know. But in those days it wasn't, you know, you didn't really look up at the sky and, you know, think, oh, maybe I'll see a UFO tonight, or maybe I'll see something strange. It just wasn't, that wasn't a part of our, of their culture. So when this happened, it was really out of the ordinary. And one of the other things too is, another sort of, I would call it kind of like, you know, ambient noise in the background, and culturally speaking, was that, you know, Mars, the fascination with Mars, and there were some very, prominent astronomers in the 19 and teens and the 20s, and who would, you know, with the advent of these telescopes, now they could look up and they could see Mars, and they could, you know, make out things on its surface. And you may recall, around this time, you had a lot of, you know, very well-respected scientists and astronomers saying, yeah, those are canals on Mars. Those are made by Martians. Hmm. Those are actually structures that we see. And you would see these pictures, and you would, you know, they would have these drawings of what they saw through the telescope. And, hey, if you're someone in 1920 and this smart person is telling you, look, those are canals, and those aren't natural. Those are made by an intelligent race of beings, and they're up there, and they have their own civilization. And a lot of people believed it. Now, it turned out they were wrong. They were 100% wrong, of course. Those canals are just sort of basically dried-out riverbeds. They've been there for how many tens of millions of years. Now, some scientists sort of said this isn't the case, but the ones who said, yes, it is true, those are the ones who got the most publicity. And they were saying, look, those are rivers. Those are canals, and there are Martian beings up there. So you have this sort of, and that started around, gosh, I would say around the time, coincidentally, that Orson Welles was born, around like 1915, 1920, somewhere around there. So that was percolating in the atmosphere as well. And so I think people who had grown up during that era, by 1938, that was maybe in the back of their mind too.
Yeah, yeah. To get into the mind, I guess you could say, of the public, at the time of the broadcast, it's important to note, we live in a completely different world now, 75 years later. You know, the whole idea of, like, breaking news, that's been done to death. Now no one even takes breaking news seriously, because half the time it's breaking news that isn't worthy of the of the hype,
right, yeah,
of breaking news. But back then, it was like a new, breaking news was a new phenomenon. It was this new thing where they would interrupt programs with breaking news about the strife in Europe at the time, and people would really be riveted by that.
Exactly. It was, people were, you know, for the first time, people were hearing their news instead of reading it in the newspapers. And of course, you know, the newspapers really saw radio as a threat. But you're right. First they, you know, they had news broadcasters reading the news on the radio. And then with the advent of technology, they came up with these sort of little remote battery operated, radio broadcast kits that these reporters, you know, they could take with them out into the field and broadcast, you know, back to the station. And so suddenly you could have people out away from the station, you know, over, you know, in Europe, as you say, reporting on what Hitler was doing. Or the most famous example is of the Hindenburg airship, right? When it crashed, and you had the reporter who was just standing right in front of it, watching his huge airship just crash to the ground. He basically lost it, and he has that famous phrase, "Oh, the humanity," you know, as he sees this thing crash. And people were listening to that live, and this is the first time that had ever happened. You're right, that people, you'd be listening to a broadcast, and all of a sudden people would just break in and say, we have a breaking news situation here. We're going to go directly to our man in the field. He's going to tell you what's going on. That was relatively new. That had only been going on for a few years because they didn't really have the technology before then. And it was something that, in a way, Americans were very naive, because they almost, and we'll see this, how this came back to bite them, but they had almost just 100% trust in what they heard on the radio. If a news person, a news reporter said something on the radio, they believed it.
Hmm.
You know, if they heard, you know, a reporter saying such and such is happening, they believed it. You know, they really had a trust in this new form of media. You know, they really just, you know, couldn't believe. They had, this had no concept of someone using this in any other way other than just to tell them what was really happening.
Exactly, yeah. So when people look back on it and they're like, oh, how could they fall for that kind of thing? You really have to put yourself in their shoes where it's like no one had... I think you mentioned that there was a British program that was similar to the War of the Worlds that happened maybe a dozen years earlier or something like that. But that was really heavily satirical, and you kind of read between the lines, and even that caused a bit of a stir. And that was over in Britain, so it didn't really quite hit the American shores that it had happened. And you just kind of have to understand that people weren't expecting someone to use that breaking news style of reporting in an entertainment program. Half the time nowadays, people don't even believe the break. You know, they're not sure what to believe anymore.
Right. I mean, reality show is kind of an oxymoron now because, you know, half the stuff you're seeing is scripted. You know, they're telling people what to say on these quote-unquote reality shows. But back then, you're absolutely right. People had a very clear, you know, a clear black line separating what they perceived to be fact and what they perceived to be fiction. There was a radio drama. You know, it had music. It had a very structured format. You know, a radio comedy had an audience. You could tell this wasn't real. Whereas a news report had a certain feel to it. And, you know, Orson Welles was the first person to kind of, as you said, use that sort of realistic technique and say, hey, that could be used in an artistic way.
Yeah, that's really like the genius of the whole endeavor in a lot of ways, you know,
right.
That thinking outside the box and a way to really create entertainment out of an unexpected place.
It's a good old Yankee ingenuity, right?
Exactly.
Something that already existed and finding a new way to use it.
Exactly. And if I recall from my film studies on Citizen Kane, that was what really, it still makes it one of the most critically acclaimed films ever, was that it really sort of it brought in a lot of elements that either had been done in sort of under-promoted films or, you know, underutilized films. You know, he would pick up little techniques and really popularize them via Citizen Kane. So
exactly. Yeah, and he did the same with War of the Worlds. Yeah, you're exactly right.
Okay, so we'll sort of jump here now to October 30th, 1978.
38,
yeah. We'll jump ahead to October 30th, 1938. I guess you make the point in the book, and we talked about it here earlier in the conversation, that this all, it wasn't planned. And you really lay it out really well in the book. So, like, I guess just give us a little bit of a thumbnail in a sense of sort of how the broadcast came together. Because as you lay it out in the book, it's not like they're all sitting around a smoky room and they're like, here's a great idea, we'll do it this way, and people will freak out. It was more like, I mean, it came down to the very end, of like the afternoon before the show, before they really settled on the format of the program. I mean, it could have gone completely differently. It could have gone in a completely different way. It could have been this mundane thing that nobody really appreciated and didn't quite capture the imagination of anybody, except for these sort of like last minute changes and things like that.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, the idea to sort of present this in the form of a realistic news broadcast was a last minute, desperate sort of Hail Mary attempt to resurrect a script that honestly none of them thought was really all that good. They had been working on it throughout the week. Orson Welles wasn't around hardly any. You know, Howard Koch he wrote the script, but Welles was busy, you know, off at one of his other, getting ready for another Broadway play. And it was all, and this was the case with pretty much everything that Welles did. I mean, it was always very chaotic and last minute. And they listened to a kind of basically a rough cut of the performance on, I believe it was Thursday night, and the actual broadcast was Sunday. So Thursday night they listened to it. They were sitting in Orson Welles' hotel room, and they recorded the rehearsal they had done earlier that day, and they listened to it, and they were like, wow, this is just not good. And so what can we do? What can we possibly do to sort of change this around? And so, again, it's sort of, who knows who actually came up with the idea? It was several people working together, John Houseman and Howard Koch and Orson Welles and a couple of others. But eventually the idea was, hey, let's try and amp up this idea of this sort of novelty that we're hearing on radio of these field reports and these breaking news. And this might be a way to really to really make this come alive, because you'll recall, The War of the Worlds, based on a novel, was written in 1898, and it's an interesting novel to read today. I think it's lost a lot of its kick just because it's written in this very sort of reserved British style, and the original story takes place in London and across Britain, and it's a very difficult novel to kind of adapt for a mainstream American audience. So one of the first things they did was change the location, you know, and tried to make it as relatable as possible. They placed the Martian invasion not in London, but in New Jersey, right? And so they made a lot of these changes, and they just kept making changes. And I think the guiding impulse for them was, how can we make people, you know, relate to this book, this story? It was written by a British guy, you know, 40 years ago. And so I think they just kept coming up with ideas, and my personal theory, and I label it as such because there's no real proof, but as I mentioned in the book, a few weeks prior to that, Wells had a friend who was a fellow playwright named Archibald MacLeish, and Wells had helped out MacLeish, and he started in a couple of his plays. It's actually one in 1937 and one just, you know, I think a few months before the broadcast, if I remember correctly. But there's a couple of these plays that MacLeish did that sort of had not exactly the same idea of using an actor to pretend to be a reporter. But because MacLeish's plays were very stylized and they were kind of obviously never written in verse, and so you knew you were hearing something that was obviously staged.
Yeah.
But he did have a couple of programs where he started off, you know, with a radio announcer describing some crazy scene in front of him, and it was a very symbolic scene about, you know, war and fascism, and it obviously wasn't real, but Wells actually starred in one of those, and then the other play that used that technique actually was broadcast just a few days before the War of the Worlds. So one theory is that he sort of got that idea from MacLeish and said, you know what, I'm going to use that tool of using a broadcaster, but I'm going to make it really, really realistic.
Yeah.
And so that's one theory as to where that came from.
It's amazing stuff. So they had no plan on it. This is a tremendously lucky and in some ways unlucky turn of events.
Yeah, and if I could just, I'll debunk some of this idea that it was a hoax. You have to remember, and a lot of people don't realize, is that his radio program is called the Mercury Theater on the Air.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the lowest rated programs across all radio, all networks. It was broadcast on CBS. It was broadcast on Sunday evenings, which is, you know, sort of notoriously sort of dead night. It had no sponsors, no advertisers. Basically, CBS paid just because they had to have something on the air, right?
Right.
They couldn't just have dead air. So they paid Wells to produce this, but they basically left him alone because it wasn't a money earner. It attracted no interest, and it was scheduled. It aired opposite one of the biggest hits of radio at the time. It's called the Chase and Sanborn Hour, and this was a show that starred Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, and I don't know if modern audiences even know who these are. Edgar Bergen was actually Candace Bergen's father, but he was a comedian back in the 40s, very popular. He had a ventriloquist dummy that Charlie McCarthy. And Charlie was this very sort of wisecracking guy, you know, instead of a lot of funny, corny jokes, basically. I shouldn't say funny because they're not really that funny.
But. Well, the thing, just to jump in here, the thing that puzzled me in a lot of ways was they must have had a live audience or something, but it's like, how does a ventriloquist act translate to radio? It's like half the appeal of the whole thing is the visual element.
I know, it's absolutely crazy. It's like, you think about it, you had millions and millions, and it was this monster hit. I'm saying this was sort of like a Seinfeld or a Friends type show.
Right.
I mean, this was just huge. It was a variety show, and you're right, it was in front of a big studio audience, but you're right. It's just the whole idea is that you're basically listening to the same guy talk in two different voices, and you know that when you hear the quote-unquote dummy talk, it's really the same guy. and you can't see it. And it's, again, it's just one of those sort of baffling things. It would never go over today, obviously, but back then, it was incredibly popular. And yeah, this is what Wells was up against, and that's why he didn't have any sponsors, and that's why hardly anyone listened to his show. And because no one listened to his show, CBS kind of left him alone. They didn't really, they sort of would peek in every now and then, and they would have someone read the script to make sure he wasn't saying anything obscene, you know, something like that. But for the most part, he was just left alone, and it turned out to come back to bite them, because if they had actually been paying a little more attention, they might have realized what was about to happen. But yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why the sort of theories that it was all planned and it was a hoax, there was just no way, because, you know, if you were going to hoax something on purpose, you would choose a program that was, you know, popular, that people were actually listening to. And as we'll talk about in a second, you know, it was a real fluke as to why, you know, a sizable number of people listened to the War of the Worlds in the first place.
That's part of the urban legend of the whole thing, I think, in a lot of ways. People think that this was like, of course it did turn out to be like this big event, but people, I think people are under the misunderstanding that going into it, it was this big event, when really it kind of just slipped under the radar and then exploded.
Exactly. Exactly.
And the other part of it, which I think is interesting, is that you really do an amazing job, obviously, of sort of taking us minute by minute through this whole thing. And I mean, we don't need to get into the sheer depth of it, because we want folks to pick up this book because it's outstanding. But what I thought was interesting, and it sort of debunks another urban legend of the whole thing, is that there were numerous indications that this was fiction. People seem to think that from beginning to end, that you wouldn't have been able to figure it out, I guess I think people think, which isn't the case at all, because right at the beginning they introduce it as fiction. They have a station break in the middle, and then at the end there's like a whole monologue from Wells talking about you know, the world is not invaded, good luck, have a happy Halloween, or something like that, where it's amazing.
Exactly.
It's just amazing that it was like that.
Because, and this goes back to, you know, again, sort of the mechanics of how this hoax happened. Really, they're only about, I'd say about 20 minutes, an hour long broadcast, there's really only about 20 minutes in the broadcast that is made up of this sort of fake news report. The entire second half of the program, it takes place, you know, weeks and months in the future, and he's walking through this wrecked, you know, New York City, and he's, you know, finding all these things, and it's obvious that it's a drama because it's happening in the future. And so there's only about a 20-minute window where it's this incredibly realistic broadcast. And so what happened was, I'll just give you sort of the brief version, is basically the Chase and Sanborn Hour, everyone tuned in to listen to it, and for whatever reason, they just had a lousy show that night. That's basically what it was. It started at 8 o'clock p.m., and I've often said, you know, I think the real sort of villain of this entire episode is whoever was the producer for the Chase and Sanborn Hour. You know, I don't know what his name was. I actually tried to track it down. I couldn't find it. Because he decided, here you have millions of people tuning in to hear Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy tell their corny jokes, and that's all they want to hear. And for some reason, this producer decides to start off the show with Nelson Eddy. And Nelson Eddy was this crooner who was very popular in the 30s and 40s, and they had him sing, it's called The Song of the Vagabonds, and it was this sort of weird song. It was from some operetta written in the 1920s, and the song had to do with some revolution in 15th century France, and it was this weird way to start off a program. And so what happened was, people tune in and they start hearing Nelson Eddy start warbling this horrible song, and they reach over and they start turning the dials, and they miss the opening of The War of the Worlds, which, as you say, they state very clearly, hey, here's a dramatic adaptation, tonight we're going to do The War of the Worlds, you know, starring Orson Welles, you know, so here we go. But the vast majority of people missed it because they were listening to Chase and Sanborn. So they're, you know, Nelson Eddy is just horrible, and they turn the dial, and so they come in a few minutes into the middle, the program, and they just hear what sounds like a reporter And he, and the actor who played the reporter does a great job. I mean, it sounds like he's out in New Jersey and he's watching this strange Martian machine sort of land on the ground, and then it sort of, this monster crawls out and starts killing people. And as absurd as it sounds, even as I say it, I say, well, this sounds crazy. Who's going to believe that? But to an audience whose only medium of entertainment, you know, was radio, and they were, you know, they trusted radio implicitly, and they missed that on the beginning, it turned a lot of them, you know, they really believed, it's like, could this possibly be happening? And again, I think you had a very vulnerable population too. You had people who were just very scared about war, and they started to very quickly panic.
The captain, conferring with someone, can't quite see who. Oh, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side, studying the object while the captain and two policemen advance with something in their hands. I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. If those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute, something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. The whole field's caught up by the woods, the cars, the gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill. Evidently, there's some difficulty with our field transmission.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Ladies and gentlemen, here is a bulletin from Trenton. It is a brief statement informing us that the charred body of Carl Phillips has been identified in a Trenton hospital. Now, here's another bulletin from Washington, D.C.